Well, thank you, TJ. I was just trying to be of service.
Thank you.
My name is Jack, and I am an alcoholic. I want to thank Liz for inviting me to come here to speak. I live in Hagerstown, Maryland. I belong to the cleverly named Hagerstown group of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's because we're the third oldest group in the state of Maryland. So that's how they did it back then. Liz invited me to come, asked me if I could be with you for the Rule 62 conference on August 13th, 14th, and 15th. And I told her, absolutely, no problem. My wife, who comes from an extended family of 70 folks who are the product, directly or indirectly, of the marriage of her mother and father, then planned a family reunion for the weekend of the 6th, 7th, and 8th. Liz then called me back and said that she was having some vision problems and this conference was going to be held on the 7th, 8th, and 9th of August. Could I come then? I said, sure, no problem. Of course, I hadn't put my wife's family reunion on my calendar. Yeah, easy for you to laugh. Well, anyway, my wife has a lot of serenity. And then I went to make an airline reservation for Friday, August the 7th. Well, that didn't work out either, so... But I'm really happy to be here, and I'm happy to see all of you here, too. I'm going to need an extra tape of this. I've got a guy at home, Robert, who called me this morning at 8:30, as is his what he's supposed to be doing. And Robert said, geez, he said, I knew you were going out of town. I didn't know you were going so soon. I said, it's the weekend, Robert. He said, oh, yeah, it's the weekend. He said, would you bring me a copy of your talk? I said, well, yeah, sure, I'll be happy to do that. So I think I'm going to need a copy for Robert, and I think I had no idea there were going to be 5,000 people here at this conference. I had no idea, but I really think it's important for Robert to know how many of you all there are. So he knows how many of you are here to hear what I have to say. Although it really does baffle me, because, you know, Robert doesn't listen to a damn thing I say when he's sitting right across from me. Usually at these events, they ask an alcoholic to speak on Saturday night, and they usually ask somebody good. Here again, I think Liz was slightly dysfunctional. And... you've already heard the best speakers, or you're going to hear the best speaker tomorrow. Usually, there is some confusion, I must say, as to whether or not I'm an alcoholic, quite honestly. I don't think I belong here, and I can certainly tell you that my 89-year-old mother does not believe I belong here. My dad was an alcoholic, and he was a bad alcoholic, and a real alcoholic as defined in the book. And my mom was married to him for 30 years, so she knows what an alcoholic is, and she's definitely that I am not an alcoholic. So you can see that this leads to some confusion for me. I'm going to put my watch up here. Not because I can really see it or pay any attention to it, but I really think it gives hope to the newcomer. So, I think most of you know that I am not a spokesman for Alcoholics Anonymous, nor am I an expert on Alcoholics Anonymous. Liz has invited me here to talk with you about my experience, and any views that I express or opinions that I express are merely my opinions. And TJ told me that if I said anything that offended you over the next 2 hours, that he was willing to take the brunt of that. And if there's anything I say that you think is okay and you appreciate, well, please tell me later, because I have a very fragile ego, and I would sure appreciate any of those attaboys. Now, if you have a cell phone, please, by all means, turn that cell phone on if you're expecting a liver transplant. But if you're not, please put it on vibrate. And that way you can enjoy your incoming call and you won't disturb the rest of us. Now, here's why I have some confusion about the legitimacy of my being here this evening. I have never been to prison, and that seems to be an important qualifier for many, many speakers. I haven't been to jail. I have not been arrested. I have not lost a job as a result of alcoholism. I don't have any children out of wedlock. And if I don't screw this thing up in 2 weeks, my wife and I will be married for 38 years. Well, my wife has been married for 38 years. There were some momentary lapses in there, which you're going to hear about in a few minutes, and you may very well want to give her a chip at the end of this talk. So I don't have any divorces or multiple marriages. I don't even have a good tattoo. So you can see why I am somewhat confused and tend to side with my mom. But our book does say that at this podium I am to, in a general way, tell you what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like now. Well, I think the general description of what I was like was I was a liar, a cheat, and a thief, and a user, abuser of people, places, and things, and I tended to drink, and sometimes was overserved. I told you my father was an alcoholic, and when I was, before I started to drink, I was about 14 years old. One night my dad and I were home alone, and my sister, my younger sister, and my mom were out, and my dad was trying to get me to do something which I didn't want to do, so we bargained together, and he came to the point where he was out of frustration. He said, look, he said, just do this thing, Jack, and I'll do whatever you want me to do. And I said, well, Dad, I'll do that. I'll make that deal. I want you to stop drinking. He said, okay. He said, I'll stop. You're right. Drinking's been causing a lot of trouble here. And, all right, I'm going to stop. And when my mom and my sister came home, I met them at the front door and announced to them that our problems were solved. Dad and I have worked this thing out. He's not going to drink anymore. And joy reigned in our house. I knew that this was an answer to prayer. I had been praying, I know my sister had been praying, that my dad would stop drinking. We were going to have a normal home. There was a God, and my prayers were worthy. And the next day, my dad got drunk. And on that day, I closed the door on God. It's not that I didn't believe that there was a God, but clearly, the God that I knew or understood was cruel, had played a terrible hoax upon me and my mom and my sister. I had no desire to have any relationship whatsoever with that kind of God. Obviously, for some reason, my prayers were unworthy. I was unworthy. And I knew from that moment on, if I was going to ever accomplish anything in life, I was going to have to do it myself. And so I set out on my journey in life. Not too very long after that, I had my first drink of beverage alcohol. And it did for me what I am quite certain it did for all of you. It changed my perception of reality. It allowed me to fit in. It permitted me to mix comfortably with other people. I could talk to girls. I could dance. I thought I could sing. I heard somebody from a podium not too long ago say that her boobs got bigger. That was not my experience. But all of the other things, you know, the pimples fall off. I could stand more erect. I could walk with confidence. This was the elixir of life. No wonder my dad drank. He just didn't know how to control his drinking. He was a weak person. And so alcohol became the social lubricant that allowed me to move through life. Now, I would like to tell you that it did not cause me any difficulty when I first began drinking, and the fact that I spent 5 years in high school as a result of a series of misunderstandings and bad breaks had a lot to do with alcohol. And when I finally got to the place where I was going to graduate, that we had to have a meeting with the school board because a number of my associates and I decided that at the time of graduation rehearsal, that was the time to celebrate our graduation. And we showed up at our old junior high school in a slightly inebriated condition. And so they weren't going to let us walk across the stage until they had to take a vote of the school board. But alcohol was not the problem. These people couldn't take a joke. That was the problem. They were humorless people. You know, I'm a fast-thinking, fast-acting drinker. I'm looking for the action. I like the excitement. And I love everything about drinking. I love drinking top-shelf stuff. I like bottom-shelf stuff. I will drink it. You give it to me. I will drink it. Give it to me in a brown paper bag. I will drink it without even asking you what's in it if you tell me this is good stuff. I don't know. I've had the occasion on, you know, cleaning up after a very nice party of picking up a bottle or a can of beer and, oh, there's a little something in that. Throw that puppy down. Ooh, what was that? I see some of you have had cigarettes to drink in the morning, too. I was up in Maine earlier this year, and there was a guy there who, at the meeting I attended, said when he came to Alcoholics Anonymous, his optic nerve was connected to his rectal nerve. And as soon as he said that, I identified with it because there was something about my outlook on life that was messed up. But alcohol would solve that problem for me. I'm going to give you a couple of snapshots of my life, a couple of things that happened along the way. Life-transforming events, if you would. I was supposed to go to California with a friend of mine. We had packed up a car, loaded it with beer, and we were going to California. Didn't know a soul, just going there to have fun. And I think if I'd have run into Doug, we would have had some fun. But my friend's father, at the very last minute, wouldn't let him go. So I went to Ocean City, Maryland, which some of you are familiar with here. And I lived there for a month as a bum, staying in the basement of hotels, living off the generosity of friends who were employed there, and eating leftover restaurant food, and I spent all my money drinking. And I was a keen observer of the Ocean City social scene, and I saw and became acutely aware that if you were a beach boy, lifeguard, if you were a bellboy, a clerk, if you were a waiter or a waitress, and you drank and acted out like I drank and acted out, they would arrest you. Now, I wanted to work in Ocean City, but I didn't want to get arrested. Now, this is where my keen observation came in. I noticed there was one group of people who did not get arrested, and they were the police. So the next year, I became an Ocean City policeman. Didn't tell you that, did I, TJ? I was a beat cop, and within the first couple of weeks of my going on the beat, it became real clear I possessed a very unique talent. I could spot an underage drinker from almost a full block away. I would track down that underage drinker, usually dragging a cooler behind him or her. I would explain to them that drinking in Ocean City underage was 30 days in jail or $300 fine, and their lives would pass before them. And then somewhere in the conversation, they would ask, "Well, officer, couldn't you just take the beer?" I said, "Well, that's a unique proposal for the solution to this problem." I said, "If I take the beer, I'm going to have to take the cooler." "Oh, you can have the cooler." Now, when you're walking a beat, it's really difficult to confiscate a lot of beer because it's hard to carry. So I worked out a deal with my lieutenant and my sergeant that they would come in their cruiser and they would pick up the beer and give it to me at the end of the shift if I would give them the whiskey. And that seemed fair. So the next year I was in Ocean City, they gave me my own patrol car. Lights, sirens, the whole works. This expanded my territory and made me much more efficient. And at the end of the shift, then I would meet with my lieutenant, my sergeant, and they would take the whiskey, knowing full well that I had a whole trunk full of stuff, because when the radio went dead, they knew I was busy. So, now here's an event that that changed the direction of my life. About 3 o'clock in the morning, I was working on the beach highway. Car came by, obviously drunk driver, stopped him, license, registration, I'm writing the ticket. The guy looks at me and he says, "You don't know who I am, do you?" And I said, "No, I don't." He said, "Well, I'm the state's attorney for Worcester County, the county you're standing in right now." I didn't know what a state's attorney was. Had no idea. I said, "Well, good for you." Sign the ticket. So he signed the ticket. There was a guy in the car who appeared to be sober. I let him drive. I went about my business. 8 o'clock in the morning, my shift is ended. I pull into the police parking lot. There, standing in the parking lot, is the chief of the Ocean City Police Department, who says to me, "Quarterman, come up to my office and bring that uniform citation book with you." Now, these were the first words that Chief Phillips had spoken to me all year. I thought, this is a good thing. I'm going to get recognition for good work. Long overdue, I might add. So I took my book and I went up to the chief's office, and when I walked in, there, seated on the couch right inside the door, was the guy I gave the ticket to at 3 a.m. Chief Phillips says, "Give me that book." I gave him the book. He flips it open to the ticket I'd wrote this guy, hands it to the guy. The guy takes out a pen and writes across the front of the ticket, "Case dismissed." And it was at that moment I decided I wanted to be a lawyer. And if I could become one of those state's attorneys, I definitely want to be one of them, because if you could dismiss traffic charges with a stroke of a pen and you drove like I drove, come in very handy. So I went to law school. And law school interfered with my drinking, cut it back to mostly weekends. But I got through law school. My wife and I had met in college, and so we got married while I was in law school. Graduated, went back to Hagerstown to be a lawyer, and there was a vacancy in the state's attorney's office for an assistant state's attorney, so I went right over and applied. I said, "Here I am, I'm the answer to your prayers, I am here to be your new assistant state's attorney." And they said to me, "What? Are you some sort of idiot? You just graduated from law school. You don't know anything. You've never been in a courtroom. You don't know anything about trying a case. We don't have time to train you. Get out of our office." At least that's what I heard. I think they said something like, "We've already filled the position." But I have learned in Alcoholics Anonymous that many of the things that I thought happened in my life never happened. It's just that I thought they happened. I have a problem with my hearing. I hear stuff that people have never said. I misinterpret things. I don't see so good either. Stuff that I thought I saw happen never happened. Don't know what that's all about, but it seems to be part of alcoholism because I've run into a lot of sponsees have the same trouble. Well, I did not know it then, but I now know that I'm a very sensitive person, and I don't take rejection very well. That's I know. Oh, I get angry, quite frankly, and resentful about things like that. Actually, I got pissed off, and I don't know about here in your community, and I'm not really sure whether we're in Kentucky or Ohio, by the way. When Liz did invite me here, I said, "Okay, Liz, where am I coming to?" She says, "You're coming to Cincinnati." I said, "Okay, and where am I staying?" She says, "You're staying in Kentucky." And I said, "And then this, what kind of conference is this? Where's this conference being held?" She says, "Well, it's being held in Cincinnati, but you're speaking in Kentucky." So I tried to explain that to my wife, but she was still smarting over the family reunion thing, so. In any event, I got a resentment, and we elect our prosecutors, so I went out and found a guy who was a lawyer who wanted to be state's attorney, and I ran his campaign for state's attorney, and he got elected state's attorney, and he made me deputy state's attorney. And when I got into that office, I discovered a serious deficiency. We didn't have any badges, and it's essential that a state's attorney have badges. So I designed a marvelous badge, even had my name on it. And when you get a badge, you get a badge case. And when you get a badge case, there's a little glassine place where you put your driver's license. So when the officer stops your vehicle and asks to see your driver's license and you exhibit that badge case and that driver's license, oh, the badge officer? Deputy State's Attorney, Washington County. "Oh, that's no problem, officer. I understand. You're just doing your job." "Yes, yes, sir. I only got a couple blocks to go." "Thank you very much, sir. You too. Good night." Are you starting to get an idea of why I don't have any arrests in my background? Gets better. A couple years later, my boss, the state's attorney, was being considered for a circuit court judgeship. And he met with the governor, and the governor told him, "I'm going to appoint you on Monday." And over the weekend, I don't know whether, you know, in Kentucky or Ohio, either one, I'm sure there are state senators who stick their nose in where they don't belong and screw things up. And that's what happened in our community. Our state senator screwed up this judicial appointment, and my guy didn't get to be circuit court judge. Now, I wasn't so upset about that as I was upset about if he'd have been circuit court judge, I'd have been state's attorney. So by screwing up that appointment, I missed out. As I told you, I'm very sensitive. I don't suffer well. And I get angry easily. So we got a couple guys together who didn't know any better. And we ran me for state senator. Now, I didn't know the state senator was going to run away with the secretary of the Appropriations Committee and abandon his wife and his children, but he did. And I got elected state senator. Now, in Maryland, when you get elected state senator, they give you a license plate. It says, "State Senator." This is a very important aid to law enforcement because it promotes efficient law enforcement activity. When they come up behind you, sometimes with their lights on, sometimes just coming up on you really fast, and they get to the point where they can see that license plate, they turn off those overhead lights. They pull up alongside, turn that interior dome light on, toot, wave, slow it down. "Yes, sir, officer. Thank you very much." Now, our state capital is Annapolis, Maryland, and that's where our legislature meets. And in Annapolis, Maryland, I suspect very much like the capital of Kentucky or of Ohio, there are people who have whose sole job is to see that any member of the General Assembly who's thirsty gets something to drink. These people are called lobbyists. And we had such lobbyists in Annapolis, and I would like to tell you about my legislative career, but I can't because I don't remember much of it, and I don't want to repeat a lot of hearsay here. My ego requires me to tell you that I did lead the 6th Congressional District to the Democratic National Convention in 1976, and just a couple weeks ago somebody said, "What was that like, Jack?" I said, "I have no idea." I was there, but I was drinking the whole time. So, the guy that got that judgeship, he didn't like it, so he quit. And I went down to see the governor, because I wanted my guy, the state's attorney, to get that position. And the governor said, "You know, I can't appoint your guy because, you know, he talked to the newspapers and there's a lot of adverse publicity and I kind of got a black eye over that. And I'm not appointing your guy. But if you'd like to be circuit court judge, I'll appoint you." Well, it's a 15-year term and it only comes around every now and then, so what the heck? Why not? So I got appointed circuit court judge. Now, when you get appointed circuit court judge in Maryland, you have to run the following year for that 15-year term. And in that election, I had an opponent, and my opponent brought Bob Hope to Hagerstown to campaign against me. And I stand before you as the only circuit court judge who ever defeated Bob Hope. Now, they don't give you a license plate when you get to be circuit court judge. But I think they circulate your picture to all law enforcement agencies in the 4-state area. As a circuit court judge, I was full of ego, full of resentment, full of anger. Not a happy camper. And drinking alcoholically. One night, the Bar Association had an educational program, on the prosecution and defense of drunk driving cases. Prosecutor's going to tell how they do it. Defense attorney's going to tell about their side of it. Sergeant Long was there with a breathalyzer, and they needed a volunteer. They wanted somebody impartial, unbiased, who could be fair. I volunteered. Fella came in from the hotel, brought in a tray, had 6 cans of beer all iced down. I said, "What's that?" He said, "That's the beer for tonight's program." I said, "You do realize that this is a 2-hour program." He said, "Well, if we run out, there's more in the back." I said, "Bring it out now, because I don't want to be drinking no warm beer." So they brought out the beer, and they got the breathalyzer warmed up, and the speeches commenced, and I started to drink, and every 15 minutes I'd blow into the breathalyzer. You know, and it'd be a .03 and .07 and .11, .16, .21, .25, .28, .32. And at that point, they called me up to the podium to give my part of the presentation. Which I am told was quite good under the circumstances. After the program was over, I said, "Who's going to drive me home?" The guy running the program said, "Geez, we never thought of that." And I said, "Well, Sergeant Long is here. I just blew a .32 in his breathalyzer. He's packing it up. I can't go out and get in my car and drive away." "Well, we don't know. I don't know about that." I said, "I'll tell you what. I'll go in the bar. When Sergeant Long leaves, you let me know." So I went in the bar, had a couple drinks. They came in, said Sergeant Long was gone. I left, went down to the Broad Axe, had a couple drinks, went over to the cellar door, had a couple drinks, and then I went home. And that was an ordinary, usual night of social drinking for the judge. Now, you know, that's what it was like. What happened, in part, was that on a Wednesday in April, another lawyer and I were going to be going out for, we said we were going out for a seafood dinner, but what we were really going out to was to just get snot flying drunk. And we proceeded to do that. We drank all that there was just about to drink where we were, and then we went over to a local night spot where all the recently separated, divorced, and single women tended to congregate, and we just went there for a nightcap. Now, you know, I was talking to you about how I love to drink and how I've even had a couple of cigarette butts to drink. My love affair, however, was with Jack Daniel's Black on the rocks with a twist. That was my love affair. Although, I must say, there's something to be said for the vodka martini. And I wouldn't want to rule that out. I would rule out gin martinis, however. I cannot stand to be in a pine forest to this day. I had a bad experience with gin. I like imported beer. I like Budweiser. Really like St. Pauli Girl. I love to drink. I want you to understand I loved it, and I loved everything about it. I love the stemware. I love the little beads of sweat running down. You know what I mean. I loved it all. So, when I tell you, if I had known this was going to be my last drink, I would have ordered something else. So I stand before you embarrassed to say that my last drink was Tia Maria. Stephanie's over here saying, what in the hell is that? And I must say, I wondered myself. I don't know why I drank that. I don't know why we ordered it. I don't know why. Obviously, I got a tainted bottle because on the way home, I got really sick to my stomach. Now, my wife's a school teacher, and the next morning, I got up, and she brings every germ in the county home. You know, if you're a school teacher, you just bring all the germs home. And so I got up the next morning, and I had bad flu. You know about bad flu, bad flu. But I went to work because, by golly, if we can suit up and show up, we do. And I showed up for work, tried a case that day, came home that night really, really sick. And next day was Good Friday, so I was off work, and I was having that upset stomach that goes with the flu. Couldn't keep anything down, was spending a lot of time on my knees. And then on Saturday, I started to develop that lower tract distress that sometimes comes. And, you know, that's a bad combination. And some of you may have known that from your own experience. Because if you got that lower tract distress and you got that upset stomach thing, you don't know whether to sit or to kneel. And it will hone your decision-making down to a really fine point. And my wife tells me that at least one occasion that weekend, I made a bad decision. So, but you'll have to talk to her about that. I'm moving on. I was admitted to the hospital on Monday. I had my abdomen was distended. They did an emergency laparotomy. I was full of gangrene. While they were in there messing around with the peritonitis, my kidneys quit. My liver was enlarged, my pancreas was digesting itself, and my respiratory system quit. So it wasn't looking good for the home team. Hagerstown's a small town, and when you're the youngest circuit court judge in a state and you go into the hospital with the flu, that's newsworthy. So I'm there, front page, below the fold, judge has flu. A week later it said, judge condition worsens. The following week after that, it says, judge placed on critical list. Now, I was becoming a public relations problem for the Washington County Hospital. And so they had determined to send me to Johns Hopkins Hospital in Baltimore. I thought this was a good thing. I never knew anybody who went to Johns Hopkins Hospital who died. All the people I knew went there, came home. Hagerstown Hospital, I knew people went there, died. So I thought going to Johns Hopkins was a good thing. The doctors told my wife that in all probability I was going to die there. And they didn't tell me that. I would have found that discouraging. And so I'm glad they didn't. But I went down to Hopkins, and I was there in intensive care for 2 weeks, and they did just about everything but hang me by my thumbs. And when they got finished, it was May the 13th, and my birthday's on May the 14th. And they got world-class doctors at Johns Hopkins. I'm telling you, these guys are top-notch. And so they came into my room, and before they could get a word out of their mouths, I told these fellows, these world-class physicians, they had to stop. I couldn't take it anymore. Tomorrow's my birthday. Give me a day of rest. And they said, well, we came to tell you that we don't know what to do with you. We presented you to the internal medicine department. We couldn't get a majority vote on what you've got. We don't know what you have. So we're going to give you a day of rest tomorrow, May 14th. 2 weeks later, May the 28th, I walked out of Johns Hopkins Hospital. My kidney functions had returned, my liver was coming back to normal, my pancreas wasn't digesting itself. They got me off the respirator while I was still in Hagerstown, so I was improved. But as you know, when you get discharged from a hospital after a stay like that, they want to have that obligatory discharge meeting where they tell you the stuff you're not supposed to do so that you don't come back. And it was a very short meeting because they didn't know what I had. So they didn't know what to tell me not to do. They just told me, don't get it again. It might kill you. And just as I was getting ready to leave that meeting, one of the doctors said, Judge, could we ask you one question? Sure. Do you drink? What a strange question. Of course I drink. I'm a lawyer. I had a professional obligation to drink with clients. Now I'm a judge. I got to drink with lawyers. I got to drink with other judges. If you had to drink with lawyers and judges or work with lawyers and judges, you'd drink too. Yeah, I drink. What's your point? How much do you drink? Oh, not very much. Why? Well, because, you know, your kidney functions return and alcohol really does a number on your kidneys and your liver is coming back to normal and alcohol really does a number on your liver and your pancreas has stopped digesting itself and alcohol really knocks the heck out of the pancreas and we'd like you to not drink. I said, for how long? They said, a year. I said, a year? Well, I haven't had a drink since that night, April the 7th, when I had that tainted bottle of Tia Maria. I guess I could do that. They said, no, Judge, no, this is Memorial Day weekend. We want you to not drink from June the 1st. And I think there are people in this room right now who can already see the injustice that they were trying to foist upon me. I was getting no credit for my 7 weeks of continuous sobriety. I want you to know I fought for those 7 weeks. An argument broke out between this judge and these two learned doctors, and the fact that they were arguing with me calls into question just how sane they were. I'm concerned about that. But we reached a compromise, and the compromise was I wouldn't drink again until April 7th of the following year, and then if I thought drinking had anything to do with the pain and suffering that I'd endured, then maybe I would choose not to drink for another 7 weeks, and that seemed fair. And that's what we agreed upon, and that's what we did. Which, unbeknownst to me, and God bless them, I mean, the docs were doing the best they could. But as Dick and I were talking a little earlier this evening, these guys get less they get either the same or less training in alcoholism than they do in dengue fever. And there hadn't been a case of dengue fever in this country for 20 years. So they didn't know what they were dealing with, and they didn't know what was going on. And neither did I. And I left that hospital, and I embarked upon the most insane period of my life. And there are people in this room who know exactly what I'm talking about. Not drinking and not changing. Absolutely the very, very worst thing anybody who's alcoholic can do. I don't know about heavy drinkers who are not alcoholic. I don't know anything about that. Maybe they can swear off forever and live happily. I don't know. But when you take away my friend alcohol, when you take away the thing that I've been using to medicate myself, when you take away the thing that has been changing my perception of reality, and you tell me I have to live without my best friend, it was horrible. It was terrible. When I was drinking, my wife and I separated three times. And each time there were women involved. And after I stopped drinking, my wife and I separated for three times. And there were women involved. So I think it's pretty clear that that drinking had nothing to do with those problems. But alcoholism had everything to do with those problems. I had two friends, Ken and Bob, who were both members of Alcoholics Anonymous. Ken ran the treatment program at the hospital. Bob ran the treatment program at the hospital, and Ken was a lawyer who I had hired when he came out of law school. And one of the things I found most attractive about Ken was he drank like me. And so we tried a lot of cases together, and we did a lot of drinking together. And I should tell you that my dad, who was a real alcoholic, on July the 3rd of 1968 was walking past a church, and on that bulletin board outside it said, "Don't buy a fifth on the third for the fourth." And that night my dad went to AA, and he never drank again. And he died with 15 years of continuous sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, if for nothing else, I owe a tremendous debt of gratitude to Alcoholics Anonymous, because it gave my dad, didn't give him back his life, it gave him a life beyond his wildest dreams or expectations. He had lost the marriage to my mother. He had lost his relationship with me and my sister. When she got married, he wasn't even invited to the wedding. I gave my sister away. She was afraid he'd come drunk. He came anyway, drunk. When I got married, he was invited to the wedding, but he was not permitted to participate. He came drunk. He lost his business. He lost his standing in the community. He lost everything of material value, but more importantly, he lost his own self-worth. And Alcoholics Anonymous gave that back to him. And I'm real grateful for that. And so when my friend Ken continued to drink and had trouble drinking after I had become a judge and he was working at the law firm, my dad became a sponsor. And Ken just had a little difficulty with his not drinking thing. And so, you know, he would go to meetings and get drunk and go to meetings and get drunk and go to meetings and get drunk. And finally my dad, said, "Look, come back when you get ready to do the not drinking thing." And, you know, he's got a book that says if you're working for somebody who doesn't want this thing, go work with somebody who does. And so eventually, a couple years later, Ken did get this not drinking thing and did get the program of recovery of Alcoholics Anonymous. And Ken and Bob, unbeknownst to me, got together. And they knew exactly what was wrong with me. I'm dying from untreated alcoholism. I'm not drinking, I'm not changing, and I'm dying of untreated alcoholism. Bob suggested to me that I might want to get a copy of the Big Book and read about my father's disease. Clever guy, that Bob. Of course, I would never have bought a book to read about my disease, because there's nothing wrong with me. You hear? I'm not drinking. I can't be alcoholic. Everybody knows. Alcoholics drink. I'm not drinking. End of story. So I read the big book, and no surprise to me, my father's in there. Yeah, he's in there. Yeah, real alcoholic, that's him. No problem. What really came as a big surprise to me was I was in there. You know, it says in that book somewhere, many of us at a very early age closed the door on God. Remember I told you when I was 14 years old? How'd they know? And there's a thing in there about Bill going into the bar, you know, and you're not going to have anything to drink. And then, you know, two or three, four or five, six drinks later, whiskey rising to his head. He said, how did this happen? Oh, what the hell. How many times did I go into Broad Axe, you know, and I said, I'm not having nothing tonight. I'll have a Coke and then I'm going home. Well, I don't want to be rude. If you want to buy the judge a drink, okay, I'll have one, no more than two. I'll be home, honey, 5:30, no later than 6. Of course, 8 o'clock, there I'm sitting. Another crowd's come in. First crowd's gone. New crowd buying a judge a drink. No point in going home now. She's going to be really mad. They've already had dinner. Might as well let her put the kids to bed, and she'll go to sleep. I'll leave when they close. But I'm never doing this again. Never doing this again. And then go back and do it again and again and again. How'd they know? I don't know how they knew. But Ken and Bob suggested that maybe I would benefit if they would come to my chambers, my judge's office, on Fridays at noon and bring that big book, and we would read the big book together and we would talk about it. Now, they were also suggesting that maybe I should go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. I can't go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. Alcoholics Anonymous has experienced a tremendous membership growth while I was circuit court judge. I knew what an alcoholic was. I knew them when I saw them, and I knew where they belonged. And so we would have this, you know, okay, here we go. We're going to give you, you got 90 days in jail. Or go to AA. Well, had this happen 3 times, I'll take the jail, Your Honor. I never knew until I heard Sandy B. say that the reason this happens is because I think all of us have been in bars and know guys that have gone to jail. And when they get out of jail, they come back. But when they go to AA, what the hell happens to them? Where'd they go? Don't come back to the bar. I don't want to disappear. I'll go to jail. So I couldn't go to AA because everybody there was there because I sent them there. But I did start to go to meetings up in Chambersburg, Pennsylvania, and I went to some meetings over in Frederick, Maryland. I went to some meetings down in Martinsburg, West Virginia. And the first time I was there, you guys caught me, and we ended up circling up holding hands and doing that prayer thing. So after that, I'd get there on time, but I'd leave early. And I could tell, you know, you can tell when a meeting's winding down, so I just get up and leave because I didn't want to be involved in that prayer thing because I got this attitude towards God. So here I am. I'm not drinking. I'm not changing. I'm reading the big book, and I'm going to meetings. Hey, I'm in recovery. That's a delusional thought. If you're looking for a delusional thought, that's a delusional thought. Delusional thoughts do not occur when you're drinking. I mean, we could get Sister Mary Margaret in here and pour a fifth of Jack Daniels in her, and she'd do bizarre things. So it's not about what we do when we're drinking. It's what we do when we're not drinking. And there's something wrong with my thinking. I did not know this. Big Book says, problem for the alcoholic, centers in the mind. Simply how I think is my problem. S-H-I-T. Simply, how I think is my problem. And it's not how I think when I'm drinking. It's how I think when I'm not drinking. And they got a whole chapter in there about sober thinking. You know, more about alcoholism. Every one of those guys is sober. Thinking I was not too smart, I put my whiskey in my milk. Duh! I didn't know I had this allergic reaction to alcohol. I did not know. I mean, clearly, if I were allergic to strawberries and I broke out in a rash, what do people do who are allergic to strawberries? There may be people in here who are allergic to strawberries. You just don't eat strawberries, right? But you don't go to Strawberries Anonymous. You just don't eat strawberries. So if Nancy Reagan was right, if Just Say No would get the job done, then we'd all go. We wouldn't have to gather up like this. So there's this other component, this mental component, this thing about how I think. There's something screwy about how I think. And Bob and Ken are telling me this, and I'm explaining to them, hey, buddy, I graduated from community college. I graduated University of Maryland in graduate school. I graduated law school with honors. I got degrees. And Ken said, they got degrees on rectal thermometers, and you know what we do with those. So I thought that was a little harsh myself, but Ken's always been a little more direct than Bob. So now here you know what I'm doing. I'm hanging around the edges of Alcoholics Anonymous. They're telling me that Alcoholics Anonymous is like a flat roof. Get in the middle of the roof. Nobody ever falls off the middle of a flat roof. Now I know Doug was in the middle of the herd, so if the zebras and the jackals come for you, same principle. If you're out on the fringes, you're going to get hammered. Yeah, right. So now it's December 22nd, 3 days before Christmas, 1989. It's Friday. Courthouse is closed. I go to lunch with my sponsors. We do not read the big book that day because we're having lunch in a restaurant in the public. And so we fellowship together and we have a nice time. We part ways. I go back to my apartment. My wife and I are separated again because I got a girlfriend. I got a primary girlfriend. I have a backup girlfriend in case my girlfriend ever finds out who the hell I really am. And, of course, I have that girlfriend for special occasions. And I got a wife who doesn't approve of any of this. And I'm managing this. I'm managing this. That's another delusional thought, by the way. You know, it says in our book we're driven by 100 forms of self-delusion. I just told you two. I mean, there are a lot more. So I go to my apartment, and the mailman has propped against the door of my apartment a package. It's a Hickory Farm cheese log package. Somebody sent the judge either a cheese log or a sausage. I don't know, but this is nice. And I go into my apartment, and I go into this little area in the center of the apartment where where I have my answering machine, and there, while the doors go to other rooms, it's kind of the center of the apartment. And I'm trying to figure out how to open this package, and it's sealed up, and I couldn't figure out how to get the thing undone, and I finally saw where the tape was. And so I zipped the tape with my car key, and I'm taking the message off the answering machine, and I lift the lid to this box, and boom! And I got blown back against the wall. 10 days before that, a federal judge had been killed in Birmingham, Alabama, by a package bomb that had been sent to his house. And 4 days before that, a lawyer in Savannah, Georgia, had been killed by a bomb that had been sent to his office. And I could smell the gunpowder, and I knew that I had opened a bomb. And all the pictures hanging on the wall behind me were riddled with shrapnel and blown off the wall. All the doors had holes blown through them. The ceiling was blown out. The ductwork was blown out. And there was a fire. And I tried to put out the fire, and I couldn't. So I went out in the hallway, and I pulled the fire alarm for the apartment. And a neighbor came, said he was going to bring a fire extinguisher, and I went back in and went to call 911. And when I went to call on the phone to press the phone buttons, that's when I first became aware that part of my right hand had been blown away. So after doing the 911 thing, hung up the phone, and it felt like my pants were being pulled off my hips. And I looked down, and I was standing in a puddle of blood, and it was just getting bigger and bigger and bigger as I watched it. And I knew I was in serious trouble. And my neighbor had put the fire out, and he asked if there was something else he could do. I said, yeah, get me a towel. And he got me a towel, and I opened my trousers, and I did not have courage enough to look to see where the wound was. I just put the towel where I thought I was injured, and I braced myself against the wall, and I slid down on the floor. And it was pretty clear to me I was dying. I could feel life draining away, and my vision was getting narrow, and it was getting dark. And I've been going to Alcoholics Anonymous now for a while, not doing anything, just attending. But somebody's getting a liver transplant. I hear the phone ringing now. So good luck on that. So I'm laying there on the floor, and I'm telling you, you talk about being powerless. I was powerless, all right. And scared to death. And I did not know what to do. And the only thing I'd learned in Alcoholics Anonymous was the serenity prayer. And I asked God to grant me the serenity to accept what I couldn't change, and the courage to change what I could, and the wisdom to know the difference. And I prayed that prayer over and over and over and over and over. And I don't know whether it was the fifth, sixth, or seventh time through, but the prayer was answered and God came. And I felt a sense of peace and well-being, the likes of which I'd never felt before in my life, and I have not felt it since. I had no assurance as to whether I was going to live or die. What I had was an absolute assurance that it was going to be okay. That if I died on that floor that afternoon, never to see my wife and our children again, it would be okay. And if I didn't, it was going to be okay. And the fire people and the emergency people, and they all came rushing in, the cops and everybody, and both my eardrums had been blown out, and I had this ringing in my head, and I couldn't hear what they were saying. And I stopped praying, trying to respond to them, and as soon as I stopped praying, fear swept upon me. And I told them, I said, you guys just do whatever you have to do. I'm going back to doing what I have to do. And I went back to praying. And as soon as I started, just like that, it came back. It's going to be all right. You're going to be all right. If you die, you're going to be all right. You don't have to worry. It's going to be all right. And they bundled me up and they put me on a backboard, cut all my clothes off of me, took everything off of me but my Christmas socks. They hauled me down the steps. We got a little NBC affiliate in Hagerstown, so they were there with their cameras. They took the picture of my Christmas socks coming out the door first. Of course, Judge gets blown up in Hagerstown, went round the world on CNN, right? What went round the world was my Christmas socks, not me. They took me to the hospital. They took me up, you know, to the trauma center. They took me to surgery. They operated on me, and they removed a piece of shrapnel from my groin area, which was not resting against, but in very close proximity to my femoral artery. And you know and I know that if it had nicked my femoral artery, we'd have a different speaker here tonight for sure. And I don't know how shrapnel knows how to stop passing through flesh. I don't know. I just know it did. So now I'm in my recovery room, and my sponsor Bob's there, sitting at the foot of my bed. And I did have a certain degree of self-pity going on, feeling kind of sorry for myself. Somebody tried to kill me. And Bob's sitting at the foot of the bed, and he's got this kind of, you know, this grin on his face. And Bob, I see you're grinning. What are you grinning about? No, nothing much, Jack. I think it must be wonderful. Wonderful, you say? I don't think it's so wonderful. What the hell are you talking about, wonderful? He said, as I understand it, that package had 4 pipe bombs in it. He said, 1 pipe bomb is more than enough to kill a human being. 2 is kind of redundant. 3, that's a little bit over the top. 4 pipe bombs, you've really made somebody very angry. He said, I would say that man has done his very best to kill you. And you're here by the grace of God. It's good to have a sponsor. I would never have come up with that in a million years. Never. He said, I think God has work for you, Jack. I said, well, Bob, what kind of work do you think God has in mind for me? He said, I really don't know. He said, I do know that it's God's will for you to be a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. He says, you've been hanging around AA meetings now and you're not doing anything. He said, I suggest to you that either you and I or you and Ken or the three of us together pray that third step prayer. You make that inventory. You do your fifth step with me or with Ken. You do the sixth and seventh step. You make the eighth step list. You begin making amends and begin living in 10 and 11 and 12 so that you can be of use to somebody. Good to have a sponsor. I wouldn't have come up with that either. Well, you know, it says in the ABCs that God could and would if he were sought. I didn't come to Alcoholics Anonymous to be a seeker of God. That wasn't even in my top 10. As a matter of fact, I've got this attitude towards God, described in the big book as bristling with antagonism. That was an understatement in my case. And Bob was aware of my antagonism, and he said, he didn't know my dad, but he knew my dad had died in AA with 15 years of sobriety, but he said to me, he said, Jack, how old were you when you prayed that God would help your dad stop drinking? I said, I was 14. He said, how old were you when he stopped drinking? I said, I was 26. He said, do you have any idea what 12 years means to infinite God? Once again, it's good to have a sponsor. I had not given that any consideration whatsoever. And he said, Jack, he said, 12 years to infinite God is a nanosecond. He said, you got awfully quick service. What are you complaining about? You're complaining about God didn't do what you wanted him to do when you wanted him to do it? Your dad died with 15 years of continuous sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous. God answered your prayer. What is your complaint? Yeah, well, okay. So he said, well, you know, what kind of God are you interested in, Jack? And I said, well, I'm not interested in that harsh, punishing, scorekeeping God that I grew up with. He said, what would you like? I said, I'd like a loving, caring, forgiving, gracious God. He says, you can have that if you take the action on the steps in the program of recovery of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, what I've been doing up until that time, quite frankly, and I think there's some of us here in this room tonight, it's what I call cake mix sobriety. We could go over to the local grocery store, get ourselves a box of Duncan Hines Red Velvet Cake Mix. We could bring it back here to this meeting. I can tell you, you can trust me on this, on the back of that box there is a 3-step program for a red velvet cake. And we could get together and we could pass it around the room and we could read it individually or we can read it together. But I will guarantee you that when we are finished reading that box, we will not have a red velvet cake. And yet that's what I was doing. I was reading a big book. Wasn't doing anything. It took no action. None whatsoever. Yes, I'd like to recover in Alcoholics Anonymous. No, I don't want to do anything that you do. Okay, Jack, bend over, kiss your ass goodbye. Our book says the alcoholic is doomed unless he learns to live by spiritual principles. I didn't know that. It's in the book. Thing was that all that time that Bob and Ken were coming to my office to try and talk to me about Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was being resistant and was part of the debating society, they knew that I didn't know. And not only did they know that I didn't know, they knew what it was that I didn't know. And I didn't know that they knew what I didn't know. So here they were trying to get me to learn something I didn't know by teaching it to me, me not knowing that they knew what it was I didn't know, because if I'd have known that they knew that I didn't know, that would have really angered me. But if you followed that, you are in the right place. And if you found that to be confusing, you're also in the right place. It just means you don't know. Because what I found out in Alcoholics Anonymous is you know when you know that you know. And not a moment before. Not a moment before. This is something that has to be experienced. I cannot by words begin to describe to you the life that has been opened up and made available to me as a result of taking action in Alcoholics Anonymous. If you don't take action on this program, Jack, if you don't take action on this program, you're doomed.
Yeah, I can handle it. How long till doomsday?
No, I can't handle it. I mean, I was thinking about killing myself. I can't handle it. I can't take it anymore, not changing and living like this. Something has to be done. Killing myself, permanent solution to a temporary problem. I didn't know that. I thought I had to live my life this way forever because it's the only way I knew how to live my life. I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, I find out there's a whole different way to live my life. And so I take action on these steps, which I know aren't going to work, which I don't think apply to me, which don't make any sense. What is this surrender to win stuff? Give it away to keep it. This is crazy. And it works. And it works. You know, I wasn't drinking and I wasn't doing much, but, you know, I wasn't drinking. And now there are these bedevilments here in our big book. Let me just read a couple of these. I mean, maybe some of you have experienced this. I don't know. We were having trouble with personal relationships. Oh, not me. Got the girlfriend, backup girlfriend, girlfriend on the side, still married to my wife. Okay, that's one. Okay. Couldn't control my emotional nature. Yes, I got angry a good bit. And yes, I was full of resentment. Okay, I'm qualified. Prey to misery. Oh, depression. Yes, you know what? Prey to depression. Couldn't make a living. Ah, that doesn't apply to me. I'm getting paid a lot of money to do what I do. And again, Bob says, yes, Jack, you are getting paid a lot of money, but you are spending money that you don't have to buy stuff that you don't want or need to impress people you don't like. And there's something wrong with that. I was spending more than I was making, so I guess I was having a problem making a living. I have a feeling of uselessness, full of fear. Not full of fear, buddy. Not me. I'm not full of fear. I am fearless. Fearless. How about snakes? What kind of snakes? Cobras. Okay. Afraid of snakes. Spiders. Well, I'm not afraid of spiders. How about tarantulas? Black widows. Okay. afraid of spiders. How about fear of commitment? How about fear of being found out? Go to your home group next meeting. Walk up behind some newcomer and just whisper ever so softly, "They know." Makes me squirm just here now. Unhappy. Couldn't see to be a real help to other people. Book calls these the bedevilments. 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 And there's a solution for all that. I no longer have anger and rage in my life today. Fear, healthy fear. Don't step out in front of oncoming 18-wheelers. I understand that part. But not that paralyzing kind of fear. Not that kind of what's going to happen. Fear of impending doom. You know, fear of impending doom really is about impending doom. Because living the way I was living, I kept getting the stuff I was always getting. If I wanted something I never had, I was going to have to do something I'd never done. The screensaver on my computer says we get what we get because we do what we do. That's a universal truth. You may not like it, but it's a universal truth. If I do the deal here in Alcoholics Anonymous, I get exactly what's promised in this book. Right on the very front cover, the very title page of this book, the very first thing it says about this book is it says, the story of how many thousands of men and women have recovered from alcoholism. Not cured, but recovered. Recovered from a seemingly hopeless condition of mind and body. And I suffered from that. And I do not suffer from it today. I've had a lot of wonderful things happen to me in Alcoholics Anonymous. I went over to Founders Day. Down in the restroom of the dormitory, guy comes in. I said, "Hi, I'm Jack from Hagerstown." He says, "Oh, I'm Woody from Baltimore." I said, "Well, nice to meet you, Woody." He says, "Yeah, I come to Hagerstown all the time." "What for, Woody?" "I bring a meeting up to the prison once a month from Baltimore, me and my sponsor." I said, "Boy, I'm embarrassed, Woody, because I live in Hagerstown. I don't know anybody that goes to the prison." He said, "Would you like to go with us?" I said, "Well, Woody, I'd like to talk to you about that, but I got to get back down to my room. I'll talk to you later about that." So I got back down to my room, and I told my roommate, Glenn. He said, "Did you give him your telephone number?" I said, "No." He said, "Well, he's never going to find you. Because there's 15,000 people at Founders Day, and if you know anything about the way they feed you there, they send you through like 8 or 10 food lines, and then they send you down a line, straight line, long, long table, hundreds of feet long, and you fill in this side, fill in this side, fill in this side, and then they start sending them down the other side, other side, other side. And I'm wondering, just kind of casually, who's going to sit in a chair across from me?" Woody. And he says, "That's him, that's the guy right there." So I've been taking meetings into prisons now since that Founders Day meeting. And believe me, with my background, going to prisons is not something I embrace with a lot of enthusiasm. First meeting I went to in prison, the guy chairing the meeting was a guy I put in prison. So. Oh, you think that's funny? Back a couple of years ago, it was really a really cold day, and I saw an ad in the newspaper. It said, "Be a lawyer in paradise," and Republic of Palau was looking for assistant attorneys general, and I sent them a resume, and I went home and told my wife I'd apply for this job. She says, "Well, where is this place?" I said, "I have no idea, but it's warmer than it is here," and forgot all about it. Spring became summer, and I got a call and asked to come for an interview, and they said, "We're looking now. You had applied to be an assistant attorney general, but our attorney general has indicated he doesn't want to renew his contract, and we wondered if you'd be interested in being the attorney general of our country." I said, "Does it pay more than the assistants?" And it did. Long story short, I became the attorney general of a country called the Republic of Palau. How does an alcoholic retired judge from Western Maryland become the Attorney General of a country? Well, in my case, I answered a newspaper ad. I called New York. I said, y'all got meetings out in the Republic of Palau? They said, no, we got them in Guam, but that's 2 hours by jet. I said, I thought that's a little far for me to go for a meeting. So I joined the loners group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and they sent me a starter kit to start AA in Palau. So I go out to Palau and find out that there's a guy there who might be a friend of Bill's. And I called him up on the phone, and he said, yeah, I am a friend of Bill's. And I said, well, do you have meetings here in Palau? And he said, yeah, we do, Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays. They just hadn't told New York. He said, we're having a meeting tonight. Why don't you come tonight? And I said, I will. I'll be there. Now, we're in a tropical climate, so it's not like a coat and tie thing. But, you know, you want to look good when you go to your first meeting of a new group somewhere. So I laid out all of my AA T-shirts, trying to decide which one I was going to wear. And as it turns out, I picked First Things First, a shirt that I don't particularly like. I don't like the sentiment, but I wore it anyway. And I went up to the National Hospital, and I was welcomed to the First Things First group of Koror, Palau. Now, I love a God shot. I really do love a God shot, because stuff like that tells me that I am in the Master's hand. I don't have to worry about anything as long as I suit up and show up and do this deal. If I start using Jack's original thinking, that's something else altogether. Simply how I think is my problem. I hope that you all are familiar with this pamphlet, A Member's Eye View of Alcoholics Anonymous. If you're not familiar with it, I suggest you become familiar with it. But let me read to you something at the very end. This coming Sunday, in the churches of many of us, there will be read that portion of the Gospel of Matthew which recounts the time when John the Baptist was languishing in the prison of Herod, and hearing of the works of his cousin Jesus, he sent two of his disciples to say to him, Art thou he who has come, or shall we look for another? And Christ did as he so often did. He did not answer them directly, but wanted John to decide for himself. And so he said to the disciples, Go and report to John what you have heard and what you have seen. The blind see, the lame walk, the lepers are cleansed, the deaf hear, the dead rise, the poor have the gospel preached to them. Back in my childhood catechism days, I was taught that the poor in this instance did not mean only the poor in a material sense, but also meant the poor in spirit, those who burned with an inner hunger and an inner thirst, and that the word gospel meant, quite literally, the good news. A number of years ago, two men, Ken and Bob, faithfully came to my office and read with me the big book. And together and separately, they steered me into Alcoholics Anonymous. And if they were here tonight and they were to ask me, Jack, tell us what you found, I would have to say to them what I say to you now. I can tell you only what I have heard and seen. It seems the blind do see, the lame do walk, the lepers are cleansed, the deaf hear, the dead rise, and over again, in the middle of the longest day or the darkest night, the poor in spirit have the good news told to them. God grant that we may always be so. My name is Jack. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is April the 7th, 1982. Thank you.